FM. Shalom from Machane Ramah in the Berkshires. This is Parsha Talk, the 2017 Tafshin Ayin Zion edition. This Shabbat, we are featuring Rabbi Barry Chesler, who is the Jewish Studies Coordinator of the Schechter School of Long Island Upper Division, and sitting in for the non-vacationing Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, who's in Poland right now, is Rabbi David Wise from the Hollis Hills Bayside Jewish Center. And I am your moderator, Rabbi Elliot Malamud, from the Highland Park Conservative Temple Congregation Anshe Emet in Highland Park, New Jersey. It's wonderful to be with you all this on Erev Shabbat. We want to wish everyone a wonderful summer. We're starting off Parsha Talk with a tremendous Parsha with Chukat. But just before we get into Chukat, we should tell our listeners, all three of them, where we are in the book of Bamidbar. We are in this fourth book, the coordinates of our Parsha, fourth book of the Torah. And we have had one calamity after another. So, Rabbi Wise, tell us what's gone on so far in Bamidbar.
So after all of the orderliness that the beginning of the book describes in terms of the arrangement of the camp and their marching orders and their schlepping orders as they are bringing pieces of the Mishkan and the way that they are to announce their departure, Bin Soah Aaron, and the way they are to announce their arrival, Uvnucho Yomar. After all that order, all heck breaks loose. And we encounter one complaint after another, one challenge to Moshe's leadership after another. He even begins to doubt his capacity to lead the people on his own. He gets help from others who have prophetic capacity, but even this doesn't seem to satisfy the people. And that leads us to Korach, right, Rabbi Chesler?
Well, we forgot the Maraglim.
The Maraglim, the spies.
So we have, as Rabbi Wise mentioned, the prophetic episode seems to be linked to the authority of Moshe as a prophet who has divine authority. The Maraglim is an attack on the corporate body. Who do the Jews, the Israelites more properly, belong to? Are they with the ten, the majority, who come back with an evil report, or are they with Kalev and Yehoshua? And then we get to Korach, which sort of bridges the two. There's a nationalist component, the threat to Moses' leadership, and then there's the family drama, Korach being a cousin of Moshe, attacking his leadership.
So if you had to do a tracking of the morale of the people at this point, if you were to do a poll of their approval rating of Moshe at this point and their optimism, their sense of optimism, where would you put B'nai Israel on the in the polling charts?
Well, they already know, the vast majority, that they are dead men and women. They've already been promised that the people will not enter the land until this generation has died out as a result of the sin of the Meraglim, of the scouts. Amazingly, immediately after that promise, that punishment, Moses, a couple of weeks ago, introduced the people to some of the laws that are tluyot baaretz, some of the agricultural laws that are connected to the land, as if to say to that younger generation, you have something to look forward to, and you have some commitments to fulfill once you get there.
So that perhaps makes the beginning of our parsha so acute, when the people feel that they're going to be dying of thirst. So they have the decree that they won't enter the land, but they, and even though they're told it will be 40 years that they will be wandering, I suspect that many of them are wondering, maybe, why should it not be now, which will set the scene for the rock.
So in other words, the morale is pretty low.
It's getting
lower. Their sense of their approval rating of Moses is also very low. Moses, I'm very critical of Moshe in both accounts, in the Meraglim and in Korach. He does not really display a lot of, political savvy. He, you know, but in both episodes, God has to intervene And Moshe, simply because he's an extraordinary figure, he remains the leader, but he's an extraordinarily flawed individual, as we're going to see in the parsha in a second. So having established now, you know, that it's a mess, but Midbar is a mess. The people's morale is low. Their sense of Moshe as a leader, Moshe has been challenged as a leader. He's had a few body checks, shall we say, as leader now, including, I guess, a 5-minute major and a 10-minute minor by some of the other people here, and lots of game misconducts too. Mm-hmm. All right, and David, he's.
I understand now that the Canadians outnumber the United States.
All right, so okay, let's start off. Chukat, we have the red heifer here. What is this doing here? Why is this here? What does this mean? What is this about? Just take us through this in the bare bones as we.
Well, bare bones is an excellent way to describe it. It's about fundamentally corpse contamination. When the Israelite would come into contact with the corpse, they would become ritually impure, and they would need to be purified in a two-part process by the ashes of the red heifer that had been specially prepared. It's a fascinating ritual because the people that are involved in the preparation of the purification agent themselves become impure. And this became the subject of much rabbinic discussion, both within and without the rabbinic movement. It's worth sharing, I think, Rashi's comment. It's identified as a chukah, zot chukat ha-Torah. This is the unexplained law of the Torah. And Rashi knows, Lafisha Satan Vumota Alam Monine Yisrael Lomar Ma Hamitzvah Hazot, that the Satan, the adversary in the nations of the world, are going to rebuke Israel, saying, what is this commandment that you have? And therefore, Rashi goes on, the Torah says it's a chukah. It is, in fact, an unexplained mitzvah. It's not one that we look for rational explanation. And it raises, to me, some important issues that are worth discussing in 2017. What do we as Jews care what the non-Jews think of us? And whether, in fact, we as Jews in 2017 believe there is any sense of hope, of unexplained phenomenon in religion.
So I think that's a profound idea. I think Jews in general are very sensitive to what the world thinks of us. We, on the one hand, display, I think, a great deal of pride in the way we organize our communities, in the way we conduct our ritual lives. We're very proud of Shabbat. We're very proud of our institutions. We're very proud of Kashrut, and we're very proud of the things that we hold fast to. And we don't have a great degree of shyness with regard to explaining Kashrut, explaining Brit Milah, explaining Shabbat, because on some level they all can be made to, they can be explained. It's when we get to the irrational that it becomes more difficult, and we get a little apprehensive. I'm trying to think of an equivalent in the taboo area of, you know, the Para Aduma. I mean, you know, Chametz on Pesach. I think Jews pretty much go crazy when it comes to Chametz on Pesach. What do you, you know, as a, it's hard to explain to non-Jews.
To a degree, the dietary laws are hard to explain as well. We spent so much time and energy focusing on the rationale of Tamei HaMitzvot, the reasons behind commandments. And what this chok and this ritual of the red heifer point to, that Rabbi Chesler identified in Rashi's comment, is that God's explanation is, because I said so. And it really is challenging language to embrace these days, because we are always looking for the rational and the rationale. But I think that religion should embrace mystery. The I do this because I'm a link in the chain, and I might not be able to explain it from any logical perspective, but I know that I do this and I identify as a Jew in so doing.
Look, there are some things that we just can't explain. I think you know, the scholarship on this has done quite an effective job in trying to explain the paradigma, but still, and we were having this discussion prior to recording this, that you have an element in religious life where it is the mystery. It is, we are touched by the infinite, and we want to bring the infinite into the finite. It's a big theme in Jewish life, and that not always comports with reason.
So it raises an interesting question for me. Is the mystery the same as because I told you so? Do we locate the mystery? Is that essentially then how we're going to describe God? God is the mysterious one, not the mysterium tremendum of Rudolf Otto, perhaps, but our source of mystery. And that what we try to do is link ourselves in some essential way to that mystery.
Through, in some cases, commandments that we can't explain or justify. And obviously, para aduma is not operative today, but for the ancients, it probably was a conduit to a connection with the mysterious.
Well, I think that this is actually quite an important dynamic going on within the Jewish world today, because there are Jews, there are sectors of the community that want all feeling, all music, all drumming, all dance, all body, and there are sectors of the community that want the mind, that want the religious experience through greater and deeper intellectual appreciation of Torah, breadth of knowledge, understanding through all of the disciplines surrounding the study of Torah. And there is a kind of tension between, I always feel this way, you know, every time, you know, there is some drumming going on, I hear the words of, you know, I hear people who are saying, you know, it's Judaism has gone into the body and not into the mind.
So elu ve'elu, derech le'elohim chayim. Both are, yes, they are indeed in tension. The role of a seeker, I believe, in our interpretation of Judaism, in conservative Judaism, is to balance that which touches our minds and that which touches our souls.
Well, which makes us more human, the mind or the body? I would suspect that most of us on some level think that our bodies are more animal than our minds. That what makes us unique as human beings is our capacity for mental and intellectual activity. On the other hand, is that the same thing as reaching for the divine? Maybe what we need the body for is to help the human in us reach for the divine.
Well, maybe we're all, you know, different kinds of instruments, to use this metaphor, in a symphony. And sometimes we can play different instruments too. Seriously, we know some people have their souls touched through the body. Some people have it through the mind. Some people play wind instruments. Some people play string instruments. Some people actualize their deepest aesthetic impulses in very tactile ways. You know, we are a very spiritually diverse tradition, and I think what this para aduma touches on, it touches on both the rational and the irrational, and it legitimizes and validates the presence of the irrational within religious life. We can all live with that. We don't need to have, you know, complete and total explanations of everything all the time, I think. With that, let's move to one of the great dramas in the story and the parsha, and that's Moshe. As we started out saying, Moshe is, I guess, at an all-time low in the approval ratings. Moshe is has really had one challenge after another. We have a lot of empathy for Moshe at this point. Person who is under tremendous pressure, and the people just can't stop going at him. They're all over him. Here the situation is water. They're in the desert. Naturally, water is going to be a problem. The people are terribly thirsty. And how does this unfold?
Well, the death of Miriam is understood by the rabbis to mean the closing up of their water source in the wilderness. So the Smichut Parshiot, the juxtaposition of the passage that tells of her death with the impending crisis of water.
So one more reason, again, for the demoralization also, especially of Moshe.
Something that one of my chanachim pointed out when we discussed the story earlier is that they don't say that they wish they had stayed in Egypt. They say that they wish they had died at the instance of the Lord, presumably referring to Korach, which is a sign of their ultimate rebellion, that they are so demoralized that they wish they had been killed as rebels.
Or is this the generation that has already been promised that they will die in the wilderness and they prefer just shoot me to a prolonged agonizing death?
All right, so let's go inside the text. I'll pick it up from Vayavo Moshe Ve'aron. It's verse 6, chapter 20. Mipnei ha'kahal el petach ha'moed. They go to the opening of the tent of meeting. Vayiplu al pneihem. They fall on their faces. Vayera kfor Adonai lehem. God appears to them. Vayedaber Adonai Moshe limor. God speaks. Kach et amateh. Take your staff. Vehakhel et ha'ida. Gather them up. Ata ve'aron achicha. V'dibartem el ha'sela, speak to the rock. Le'enehem, before their very eyes, v'natan me'mav, v'otzeta lehem mayim min ha'sela. Thus you shall produce water for them from the rock, and provide drink for the congregation and their beast. V'shkita et ha'ida et b'ra. I have to say, this is one of the strangest passages in the Torah. Speak to the rock. This is Moshe, who has this fierce sense of action, and this is Moshe who now is told to use his words, and speaking to inanimate objects, as we all know, is makes one incredulous.
In the satire class that I teach with Machon, when we watch episodes of Hayudim Ba'im, the Israeli sketch comedy show on Jewish history, including the Torah. So in this sketch, God tells Moses to speak to the rock, and Moses says, "Do you wake up every morning trying to figure out how can I humiliate Moses today? Why don't you talk to a bush?" Oh, wait, that was last week. As if, and also addressing Moses' weak muscle, which is speech, which doesn't really find its, he doesn't really find his voice until the next book of the Torah.
Well, it was Chekhov who said, I believe, that you don't introduce a gun in the first act of a play if it's not going to go off by the third act. So we have to remember that he takes the staff because he's supposed to hit the rock. What the speech is doing here isn't clear, and it's interesting looking at the comment of Sa'adja Gaon. So as Rabbi Melman said, the Dibartem El Hasela, speak to the rock, and Sa'adja says, Al Hasela, on the rock, Votseta Ba'adja Sulahemayim, that therefore the water will come forth. And the commentary on Rasag notes, Lo Shadibir El Hasela, Ki Ein Lo Ozen. That he's not speaking to the rock as if it had an ear. He's speaking in the general direction of the rock.
Still, it doesn't make sense. And still, I want to just kind of feel a sense of empathy for Moshe. Totally frustrated person, frustrated with the people. I would say frustrated with God as well. And at this moment, he loses it. I mean, there's no other way to say it. He loses it.
So what is the action of his losing it? Is it that he hit the rock twice? Is it that he said, shall we bring forth, you rebels, shall we bring forth this water?
What you mean, we?
White man. Is it is it everything together? Is it like the crystallization of everything that Moses could have done that would have shown him losing control, that he did all of them because he had actually completely lost control,
including the loss of faith, which is what God accuses Moshe and Aaron of doing in the response in verse 12. Ya'an lo he'emantem bi lehakdisheni. Why say, hamin hasela hazen notzi lachem mayim? Question mark. shall we get water for you out of this rock, when God has already asserted that they will be able to draw water from the rock?
Right, and then we come back to the end of the story, which I've always found puzzling as well. Hema me Merivah. These are the waters of Merivah. Asher ravu b'nei Yisrael et Adonai. That b'nei Yisrael fought with God. Vayikadesh bam. Yet he was sanctified there. So the story comes back to Israel, the people in a state of rebellion. But how has God been sanctified here? Is it by announcing in some way that everyone understands, which is also kind of curious? How do they know that Moshe and Aaron are not going into the land?
So, whereas the commentary in Chumash Eitz Chaim says that God is sanctified by still providing water even when Moshe blows the instructions, one might also say that God is sanctified by firing Moses at this moment to demonstrate that the people will enter this land and it is God uniquely in a form of Kedusha, right, who's bringing the people in and not Moses.
But most of the time when God communicates after Sinai, he tells Moshe or Moshe and Aaron to speak to the people, to tell them what he just told them. Here, he just tells them, Moses and Aaron have been fired, to use your nice image. But how do the people know?
I think deep in the story is a sense of great conflict. Great conflict between Moshe and the people, great conflict between Moshe and God. After all, if you imagine an alternate story where Moshe listens to God and speaks to the rock, we don't get this kind of rupture in the relationship that ultimately moves towards its resolution by the end of Dvarim. We're going to fast forward a little bit. We go into Dvarim, and these will be in the summer parsha. The idea that Moshe can't get into the land is so painful to him, and it's such a source of tension. And it starts right here. It's in this parsha where the rupture is made, and I think it has profound ramifications. I mean, what Moshe does here, how Moshe responds, and I want to be sympathetic to his response. He's frustrated. He's low. He's lost his sister. He's going to lose his brother. He is, had to face down two insurrections, basically. You know, what more do you want from me?
Right, but ultimately, it's what allows any Jew to identify with Moshe.
Yeah.
As, you know, our favorite rabbi, Mick Jagger, said, you can't always get what you want. And that's true of us. So Moses will ascend at the end of his life to get a glimpse of the promised land, just like each of us. We all die on the east side of the river.
With some degree of unfulfilled lives. But that doesn't mean that you can't set others up for success. And so immediately after receiving his pink slip, date pending, Moshe then sends messengers to help the Israelites on their journey, take a few steps closer toward the promised land. They have to take the long way around Edom for a variety of reasons, but at the very least, Moshe hasn't given up his leadership responsibilities.
So I'm glad you made a good segue into that, because the rest of the Parsha now deals with some of the real tribulations of going through the desert and encountering these hostile nations that don't grant passage to Israel. They're mean. They're unkind. They engage in battle, the Canaanites, the Amorites, Sichon Og, you know, the people that are listed in the long psalm, Hodu Lashem Kitov, Og Melech HaBashan, Sichon Melech Amri, Kil Yalam Chazdo. You know, we have to do battle against them. That's part of the way forward.
Right, and there's going to be a shift now, because now Israel is going to begin encountering successes.
Yeah.
So this seems to be the critical point. This is the lowest of the low. But now, perhaps, because Moshe is freed from worrying about reaching his goal, which is beyond him, he can now lead the people as they need to be led. You know, I just want to add one thing that struck me based on your earlier comment, that you want to feel for Moshe, and I think what came to me while you were speaking is that Moshe remains ultimately the faithful servant of God, even though flawed.
Even though flawed.
And yeah, that's an accessible model. If Moshe were perfect, like the Avot and Imahot, like the matriarchs
or
and patriarchs.
Or like our rival.
Yeshu.
Yes. Then there would be, it'd be much more difficult to emulate. So you set the scene already for next week for Balak, and this is obviously a good place to put a bow on our conversation here. We're wishing our Chanichim and Chavrei Tzeved a wonderful Shabbat. This Shabbat, hey, it's Rabbi Ethan Linden's first Shabbat with the Machaneh as the new director of Machaneh Ramah and the Berkshires. We want to give him a shout out. We want to say a special bracha of Shabbat Shalom. May it be a Shabbat of fulfillment and blessing, and may there be good weather, and may it be a real Shabbat of warmth and peace and simcha, joy for all of us, for the Machaneh and for Klal Yisrael.
Amen. Rabbi Linden.
For Rabbi Chesler, Rabbi Wise, and myself, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. FM.